I'm David Delegater. Our guest today, Terry Teachout, is the drama critic of the Wall Street Journal, the critic at large of Commentary, and the author of Sightings, a biweekly column for the Friday Journal about arts in America. He's written the libretti for three operas, is the author of numerous books, including Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong, and The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. He served on the National Council on the Arts from 2004 to 2010 and was a Guggenheim Fellow for 2012. He has a great new book out, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, one of our geniuses of American arts. Terry Teachout, welcome to Around Cincinnati. It's great to have you on. I really enjoyed reading the book. I mean, the research you did on this was just astounding, and I learned a lot about Ellington's life. I mean, I think he had a public persona that belied who he actually was in private with all of his friends and associates. Is that an accurate statement?
It's exactly right. Ellington was a man who really deeply believed in keeping his private life, and I think his private personality, strictly private. He liked to keep the world at arm's length, partly because he led a rather complicated sex life, which he didn't want to get into the papers, but I think mostly because, like many creative people, he felt that the act of making music was a kind of magic, and he didn't want to look at it too closely, and he didn't want other people to look at it too closely.
Unlike many of the musicians in his band and other contemporary artists at the time, he was from a middle-class background in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and that's important in understanding him. Because Ellington, he is a member of the black middle class, the black bourgeoisie. His family is impeccably middle class, and he acquired those manners, that way of presenting himself to the public, right from the start of his life. And it became integrated into his public image as the great, elegant, charismatic Duke Ellington. And it had a lot to do with his ability to win acceptance in the white world, where other black jazz musicians who didn't have that kind of savoir-faire might not have been looked at that way.
At one point in the book, you stated, maybe more than once, that he didn't necessarily consider himself to be a jazz composer or a jazz artist.
No, he didn't like the word jazz. A lot of jazz musicians of his generation didn't like the word because it had sexual connotations, and they wanted jazz to be seen as a serious music, an art music. And so Ellington tried coining different phrases. At one point, he said that what he wrote was Negro folk music. None of them stuck. And the word jazz is now completely, impeccably respectable. But you can see what his concern was and what he was getting at. He wanted the respectability for jazz that he also wanted for himself as a person.
With his compositions, it seems like that you could almost split them into two classes, the things that were purely instrumental and then tunes that became popular song, part of the arc of American popular music.
That's exactly right. There were the instrumentals, there were the pop songs, they were intimately related. It was the same voice that is heard in both of them. But I think the instrumentals are more central to his genius as a composer. And also, one of the things I discovered in working on this book, Ellington was not a natural writer of melody, and most of the pop songs that we identify him with, like Mood Indigo, like Sophisticated Lady, those melodies were written either entirely by or in collaboration with members of his band who were more facile melodists than he was. That's a side of Ellington's compositional gifts and deficits that we don't understand very well, that we don't talk about, and I try to explain it in the book.
Could you talk about his style of composition? Not so much style, but how he went about composing, his thought process?
He's always listening, remember. I mean, he's out on the road constantly. He basically wrote nine-tenths of his music on the road in hotel rooms, backstage, and dressing rooms. And he's with the band nearly every day of his life. So he's hearing these great master musicians with their solos and their striking individual colors and their personalities. And he's trying to make them part of the total picture of his music. And that's how it worked. That's how it was structured. You know, Johnny Hodges might stand up one night in Cleveland and blow a solo, and there's eight bars that Ellington really likes, and he scribbles them down on the cuff of his shirt. And a couple of days later, he brings in a composition that's based on those eight bars. And sometimes he paid Hodges, and sometimes he didn't.
That seemed to be a critical element in the way that he related or didn't relate to members of the band, or vice versa, that he would hear things and adapt them to the compositions and take credit perhaps for something he didn't write himself, but he was actually like the director of a movie, the auteur that put it all together.
The best possible comparison, I think, he and Orson Welles were friends, and they both went at this the same way. Now, most of Ellington's instrumental compositions are entirely his own work, but he was always listening, not just to the band members, but to everything around him, all the sounds around him. And he had that kind of creative magpie mind that would allow him to take a little bit from here and a little bit from there and pass it through the great Ellington machine, and what comes out sounds like and is Ellington music.
When he sat down to do his chart, so to speak, they were initially mostly chords, right? And
yeah,
the melodies were woven into it from lines that he may have heard from the other members of the band.
Oh, that's right. Ellington is primarily a harmonist. His great gifts are for harmony, for rhythm, for instrumental color, not for melody. And when you listen to a song like Mood Indigo, that opening section, that's just a series of harmonies that come by. And then when the clarinet comes in with a tune, that's not Ellington's tune. Barney Bigard, the clarinet player, wrote that tune. Probably he got some of it from his old clarinet teacher. But Ellington's not a plagiarist. He's a person who takes the materials of music from all around him and transforms them into something that's entirely his own. But to understand him, you've got to understand that there is a process of transformation happening here.
In America, certainly, I think traditionally jazz record sales or CDs or whatever media you're into represented about, I think, 1.5% of the market. How do you convey to people today the importance of Ellington and what he's meant to jazz, to creative American music?
You have to tell them that it wasn't like that back then, that jazz in the 20s and 30s is our popular music. It's as much a part of popular music as the songs of a songwriter like George Gershwin. And Ellington, by extension, was the Elvis Presley of his time, the Bruce Springsteen of his time, the Kanye West of his time. He was that big a figure, a media figure, known on radio, known from the films. When television came along, he was a very prominent television personality. He was big, and it's easy for us today to forget that, but it's true.
Toward the end of his life, he became kind of a sad character, it seems. I don't know. That was the impression
lonely.
I got. Lonely.
He was very lonely. He's out there on the road. He's playing increasingly in the 70s. You know, he's playing dances in towns where he might not otherwise have gone because his music is not quite as popular as it used to be. He has no permanent companion out there. There's just a succession of women. And Mercer Ellington, his son, who handled the band's business, said he could always tell when Duke was lonely because he was the one who paid the phone bills. And when the long-distance bills went up, that meant that Ellington was feeling lonely out there in Podunk.
One thing I really liked about the book, toward the end, you had a list of 50 essential pieces of Ellington music that people could listen to if they wanted to familiarize themselves with some of his best work. I thought that was like a really wonderful thing to do because I think people today don't necessarily know much about Duke, and it was just a great way to cap the book off.
I thought it was important, and also I made a point of choosing selections that could all be downloaded so that wherever you are at any time, you can look at this list and you can say, oh, that looks interesting. What does that sound like? You go to your computer, you got it in 10 seconds, and you can find out what it sounds like.
The book was a great read, and thanks for being with us, Terry Teachout.
Oh, my pleasure entirely. Thanks for having me.
Duke Ellington was an amazingly complex human being, and for sure one of the geniuses of American composition, both of jazz and more classically oriented music. Terry Teachout's book, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, is perhaps now the seminal work in reviewing his life. For Around Cincinnati, I'm David Delegater. Thank you.
Thank you.